Welcome to another Drift Off episode, the podcast where we drift off each night into the world of imagination just before we fall fast asleep. I'm your host, Joanne, and it's a pleasure helping you get restful sleep. Tonight, I have the pleasure of whisking you away on a journey with the top three bedtime stories that captured the hearts of Drift Off listeners in 2023. We will begin with Chapter 1 of Maida's Little Shop by Enos Haynes Irwin, followed by the story of Pretty Goldilocks, a French fairy tale by Madame d'Aulnois, and lastly, a tale from Finland called The Princess Mouse. And so, my friend, snuggle up under those blankets, fluff up your pillows, and let the magic of these delightful stories be your gentle guide into the land of dreams. Whether the day has been long or short, whether it's been filled with joys or challenges, this moment, here and now, is for you to relax, to unwind, and to prepare for a restful sleep. And as you settle in, feel the softness of your pillow and the warmth of your cozy blankets. You are safe. Safe from the external world and all of its distractions. It's just you and me now. And I'm here to help you relax and feel safe, and to help you drift off peacefully. So let's begin with a full, comfortable breath, holding it at the top for a brief moment, and letting it out slowly. And continue to take a few more full, deep breaths in this way at your own pace. With each breath, you feel more relaxed, more at ease. Your mind begins to slow down, and your body softens, and you can feel yourself letting go and welcoming the serenity of this quiet, restful moment. Let those worries of the day just melt away. Here in our shared space of calm and comfort, let us drift together now into the magical realm of storytelling. And so, my friend, just lay back, relax, and enjoy the story. Chapter 1, The Ride. Four people sat in the big, shining automobile. Three of them were men. The fourth was a little girl. The little girl's name was Maida Westerbrook, The three men were Buffalo Westerbrook, her father, Dr. Pierce, her physician, and Billy Potter, her friend. They were coming from Marblehead to Boston. Maida sat in one corner of the back seat, gazing dreamily out at the whirling country. She found it very beautiful and very curious. They were going so fast that all the reds and greens and yellows of the autumn leaves melted into one variegated band. A moment later, they came out on the ocean, and now on the water side were two other streaks of color. One, a spongy blue that was sky, another, a clear shining blue that was sea. Maida half shut her eyes, and the whole world seemed to flash by in ribbons. "May I get out for a moment, Papa?" she asked suddenly in a thin little voice. "I'd like to watch the waves." "All right," her father answered briskly. To the chauffeur, he said, "Stop here, Henry." To Maida, "Stay as long as you want, Posy." Posy was Mr. Westerbrook's pet name for Maida. Billy Potter jumped out and helped Maida to the ground. The three men watched her limp to the seawall. She was a child whom you would have noticed anywhere because of her luminous, strangely quiet gray eyes and because of the ethereal look given to her face by a floating mass of hair, pale gold and tenderly. And yet I think you would have known that she was a sick little girl at first glance. When she moved, it was with a great slowness, as if everything tired her. She was so thin that her hands were like claws and her cheeks scooped in instead of out. She was pale, too, and somehow her eyes looked too big. Perhaps this was because her little heart-shaped face seemed too small. "You've got to find something that will take up her mind, Jerome," Dr. Pierce said, lowering his voice. "And you've got to be quick about it. Just what Grindschmidt feared has come. The languor, the lack of interest in everything. You've got to find something for her to do." Dr. Pierce spoke seriously. He was a round, short man, just exactly as long any one way as any other. He had springy gray curls all over his head and a nose like a button. Maida thought that he looked like a very old but very jolly and lovable baby. When he laughed, and he was always laughing with Maida, he shook all over like jelly that has been turned out of a jar. His very curls bobbed, but it seemed to Maida that no matter how hard he chuckled, his eyes were always serious when they rested on her. Maida was very fond of Dr. Pierce. She had known him all her life. He had gone to college with her father. He had taken care of her health ever since Dr. Grindschmidt left. Dr. Grindschmidt was the great physician who had come all the way across the ocean from Germany to make Maida well. Before the operation, Maida could not walk. Now she could walk easily. Ever since she could remember, she had always added to her prayers at night a special request that she might someday be like other little girls. Now she was like other little girls, except that she limped. And yet now that she could do all the things that other little girls did, she no longer cared to do them, not even hopping and skipping, which she had always expected would be the greatest fun in the world. Maida herself thought this was very strange. "But what can I find her to do?" Buffalo Westerbrook said. You could tell from the way he asked this question that he was not accustomed to take advice from other people. Indeed, he did not look it, but he looked his name. You would know at once why the cartoonists always represented him with the head of a buffalo. Why, gradually, people had forgotten that his first name was Jerome and referred to him always as Buffalo Westerbrook. Like the buffalo, his head was big and powerful and emerged from the midst of a shaggy mane. But it was the way in which it was set on his tremendous shoulders that gave him his nickname. When he spoke to you, he looked as if he were about to charge, and the glance of his eyes set far back of a huge nose cut through you like a pair of knives. It surprised Maida very much when she found that people stood in awe of her father. It had never occurred to her to be afraid of him. I've racked my brains to entertain her, Buffalo Westerbrook went on. I've bought her every gimcrack that's made for children. Her nursery looks like a toy factory. I've bought her prize ponies, prize dogs, and prize cats, rabbits, guinea pigs, dancing mice, talking parrots, marmosets. There's a young menagerie at the place in the Adirondacks. I've had a dollhouse and a little theater built for her at Pride's. She has her own carriage, her own automobile, her own railroad car. She can have her own flying machine if she wants it. I've taken her off on trips. I've taken her to the theater and the circus. I've had all kinds of nurses and governesses and companions, but they've been mostly failures. Granny Flynn's the best of the hired people, but of course Granny's old. I've had other children come to stay with her. Selfish little brutes they all turned out to be. They'd play with her toys and ignore her completely. And this fall, I brought her to Boston, hoping her cousins would rouse her. But the Fairfaxes decided suddenly to go abroad this winter. If she'd only express a desire for something, I'd get it for her. If it were one of the moons of Jupiter. It isn't anything you can give her, Dr. Pierce said impatiently. You must find something for her to do. Say, Billy, you're an observant little duck. Can't you tell us what's the matter? Buffalo Westerbrook smiled down at the third man of the party. The trouble with the child, Billy Potter said promptly, is that everything she's had has been prize. Not that it spoiled her at all. Petronilla is as simple as a princess in a fairy tale. Petronilla was Billy Potter's pet name for Maida. Yes, she's wonderfully simple, Dr. Pierce agreed. Poor little thing. She's lived in a world of bottles and splints and bandages. She's never had a chance to realize either the value or the worthlessness of things. And then, Billy went on, nobody's ever used an ounce of imagination in entertaining the poor child. Imagination? Buffalo Westerbrook growled. What has imagination to do with it? Billy grinned. Next to her father and Granny Flynn, Maida loved Billy Potter better than anybody in the world. He was so little that she could never decide whether he was a boy or a man. His chubby, dimply face was the pinkest she'd ever seen. From it twinkled a pair of blue eyes the merriest she had ever seen, and falling continually down into his eyes was a great mass of flaxen hair, the most tousled she'd ever seen. Billy Potter lived in New York. He earned his living by writing for newspapers and magazines. Whenever there was a fuss in Wall Street, and the papers always blamed Buffalo Westerbrook if this happened, Billy Potter would have a talk with Maida's father. Then he wrote up what Mr. Westerbrook said, and it was printed somewhere. Men who wrote for the newspapers were always trying to talk with Mr. Westerbrook. few of them ever got the chance. But Buffalo Westbrook never refused to talk with Billy Potter. Indeed, the two men were great friends. He's one of the few reporters who could turn out a good story and tell it straight as I give it to him, Maida had once heard her father say. Maida knew that Billy could turn out good stories. He had turned out a great many for her. "What has imagination to do with it?" Mr. Westbrook repeated. "It would have a great deal to do with it, I fancy," Billy Potter answered, "if somebody would only imagine the right thing." "Well, imagine it yourself," Mr. Westbrook snarled. "Imagination seems to be the chief stock in trade of you newspaper men." Billy grinned. When Billy smiled, two things happened, one to you and the other to him. Your spirits went up, and his eyes seemed to disappear. Maida said that Billy's eyes crinkled up. The effect was so comic that she always laughed, not with him, but at him. "All right," Billy agreed pleasantly. "I'll put the greatest creative mind of the century to work on the job." "You put it to work at once, young man," Dr. Pierce said. "The thing I'm trying to impress on you both is that you can't wait too long." Buffalo Westbrook stirred uneasily. His fierce blue eyes retreated behind the frown in his thick brows until all you could see were two shining points. He watched Maida closely as she limped back to the car. "What are you thinking of, Posey?" he asked. "Oh, nothing, Father," Maida said, smiling faintly. This was the answer she gave most often to her father's questions. "Is there anything you want, Posey?" he was sure to ask every morning. Or, "What would you like me to get you today, little daughter?" The answer was invariable, given always in the same soft, thin little voice. "Nothing, Father, thank you." "Where are we now, Jerome?" Dr. Pierce asked suddenly. Mr. Westbrook looked about him. "Getting towards Revere." "Let's go home through Charleston," Dr. Pierce suggested. "How would you like to see the house where I was born, Maida? That old place on Warrington Street I told you about yesterday. I think you'd like it, Pinkwink." Pinkwink was Dr. Pierce's pet name for Maida. "Oh, I'd love to see it." A little thrill of pleasure sparkled in Maida's flat tones. Dr. Pierce gave some directions to the chauffeur. For 15 minutes or more, the men talked business. They had come away from the sea and the streams of yellow and red and green trees. Maida pillowed her head on the cushions and stared fixedly at the passing trees, but her little face wore a dreamy, withdrawn look as if she were seeing something very far away. Whenever Buffalo Westbrook's glance shot her way, his thick brows pulled together into the frown that most people dreaded to face. "Now down the hill and then to the left," Dr. Pierce instructed Henry. Warrington Street was wide and old-fashioned. Big elms marching in a double file between the fine old houses met in an arch above their roofs. At intervals along the curbstones were hitching posts of iron, most of them supporting the head of a horse with a ring in his nose. Beside these hitching posts were rectangular blocks of granite, stepping stones for horseback riders and carriage folk. "There, Pinkwink," Dr. Pierce said. "That old house on the corner. Stop here, Henry, please. That's where I was brought up. The old swing used to hang from that tree, and it was from that big bough stretching over the fence that I fell and broke my arm." Maida's eyes brightened. "And there's the garret window where the squirrels used to come in," she exclaimed. "The same," Dr. Pierce laughed. "You don't forget anything, do you?" "My goodness me, how small the house looks, and how narrow the street has grown. Even the trees aren't as tall as they should be. Maida stared. The trees looked very high indeed to her, and she thought the street quite wide enough for anybody, the houses very stately. "Now show me the school," she begged. "Just a block or two, Henry," Dr. Pierce directed. The car stopped in front of a low, rambling wooden building with a yard in front. "That's where you covered the ceiling with spitballs?" Maida asked. "The same," Dr. Pierce laughed heartily at the remembrance. It seemed to Maida that she had never seen his curls bob quite so furiously before. "It's one of the few wooden primary buildings left in the city," he explained to the two men. "It can't last many years now. It's nothing but a rat trap. But how I shall hate to see it go." Opposite the school was a big, wide court, shaded with beautiful trees, maples beginning to flame, horse chestnuts a little browned. It was lined with wooden toy houses, set back of fenced-in yards and veiled by climbing vines. Pigeons were flying about, alighting now and then to peck at the ground or to preen their green and purple necks. Boys were spinning tops. Girls were jumping rope. As she stared, charmed with the picture, a little girl in a scarlet cape and a scarlet hat came climbing up over one of the fences. Quick, active as a squirrel, she disappeared into the next yard. "Primrose Court," Dr. Pierce exclaimed. "Well, well, well." "Primrose Court," Maida repeated. "Do primroses grow there?" "Bless your heart, no," Dr. Pierce laughed. "It was named after a man called Primrose, who used to own a great deal of the neighborhood." But Maida was scarcely listening. "Oh, what a cunning little shop," she exclaimed. "There, opposite the court. What a perfectly darling little place." "Good Lord, that's Connor's," Dr. Pierce explained. "Many a reckless penny I've squandered there, my dear." Connor's was the funniest, old, bent, dried-up man. "I wonder who keeps it now." As if in answer to his question, a wrinkled old lady came to the window to take a paper doll from the dusty display there. "What are those yellow things in that glass jar?" Maida asked. "Pickled limes," Dr. Pierce responded promptly. "How I used to love them." "Oh, Father, buy me a pickled lime," Maida pleaded. "I've never had one in my life, and I've been crazy to taste one ever since I read Little Women." "All right," Mr. Westerbrook said. "Let's come in and treat Maida to a pickled lime." A bell rang discordantly as they opened the door. Its prolonged clangor finally brought the old lady from the room at the back. She looked in surprise at the three men in their automobile coats and at the little lame girl. Coming in from the bright sunshine, the shop seemed unpleasantly dark to Maida. After a while, she saw that its two windows gave it light enough, but that it was very confused, cluttery, and dusty. Mr. Westerbrook bought 4 pickled limes, and everybody ate, 3 of them with enjoyment. Billy, with many wry faces and a decided stung after the first taste. "I like pickled limes," Maida said after they had started for Boston. "What a funny little place that was. Oh, how I would like to keep a little shop just like it." Billy Potter started. For a moment, it seemed as if he were about to speak. But instead, he stared hard at Maida, falling gradually into a brown study. From time to time, he came out of it long enough to look sharply at her. The sparkle had all gone out of her face, She was pale and dream-absorbed again. Her father studied her with increasing anxiety as they neared the big house on Beacon Street. Dr. Pierce's face was shadowed, too. "Eureka! I found it!" Billy exclaimed as they swept past the state house. "I've got it, Mr. Westerbrook."
"Got what?"
Billy did not answer at once. The automobile had stopped in front of a big red brick house. Over the beautifully fluted columns that held up the porch hung a brilliant red vine. Lavender-colored glass here and there in the windows made purple patches on the lace of the curtains.
"Got what?" Mr. Westerbrook repeated impatiently.
Billy did not answer at once. "That little job of the imagination that you put me on a few minutes ago," Billy answered mysteriously. In a moment, he added with a significant look at Maida, "You stay too, Dr. Pierce. I want your approval." The door of the beautiful old house had opened, and a man in livery came out to assist Maida. On the threshold stood an old silver-haired woman in a black silk gown, a white cap and apron, a little black shawl pinned about her shoulders. "How's my lamb?" she asked tenderly of Maida. "Oh, pretty well," Maida said dully. "Oh, Granny," she added with a sudden flare of enthusiasm, "I saw the sweetest little shop. I think I'd rather tend shop than do anything else in the world." Billy Potter smiled all over his pink face. He followed Mr. Westerbrook and Dr. Pierce into the drawing room. Maida went upstairs with Granny Flynn. Granny Flynn had come straight to the Westerbrook house from the boat that brought her from Ireland years ago. She had come to America in search of a runaway daughter, but she had never found her. She had helped to nurse Maida's mother in the illness of which she died, and she had always taken care of Maida herself, that Maida loved her dearly. Sometimes, when they were alone, Maida would call her Dame, because she said, "Granny looks just like the dame who comes into fairy tales." Granny Flynn was very little, very bent, very old. 1,009 sure," she always answered when Maida asked her how old. Her skin had cracked into 100 wrinkles, and her long sharp nose and her short sharp chin almost met. But the wrinkles surrounded a pair of eyes that were a twinkly, youthful blue, and her downturned nose and upgrowing chin could not conceal or mar the lovely sweetness of her smile. Just before Maida went to bed that night, she was surprised by a visit from her father. "Posy," he said, sitting down on her bed, "did you really mean it today when you said you would like to keep a little shop?"
"Oh, yes, father. I've been thinking it over ever since I came home from our ride this afternoon. A little shop, you know, just like the one we saw today."
"Very well, dear. You shall keep a shop. You shall keep that very one. I'm going to buy out the business for you and put you in charge there. I've got to be in New York pretty steadily for the next 3 months, and I've decided that I'll send you and Granny to live in the rooms over the shop. I'll fix the place all up for you, give you plenty of money to stock it, and then I expect you to run it and make it pay." Maida sat up in bed with a vigor that surprised her father. She shook her hands, a gesture that with her meant great delight. She laughed. It was the first time in months that a happy note had pealed in her laughter. "Oh, Father, dear, how good you are to me. I'm just crazy to try it, and I know I can make it pay if hard work helps." "All right, that's settled.
But listen carefully to what I'm going to say, Posey. I can't have this getting into the papers, you know. To prevent that, you're to play a game while you're working in the shop, just as princesses in fairy tales had to play games sometimes. You're going in disguise, do you understand? Yes, Father, I understand. You're to pretend that you belong to Granny Flynn, that you're her grandchild. You won't have to tell any lies about it. When the children in the neighborhood hear you call her Granny, they'll simply take it for granted that you're her son's child. Or I can pretend I'm poor Granny's lost daughter's little girl, Maida suggested. If you wish, Billy Potter's going to stay here in Boston and help you. You're to call on him, Posey, if you get into any snarl. But I hope you'll try to settle all your own difficulties before turning to anybody else. Do you understand? Yes, Father. I'm so happy. Does Granny know? Yes. Maida heaved an ecstatic sigh. I'm afraid I shan't get to sleep tonight, just thinking of it. But she did sleep, and very hard. The best sleep she had known since her operation. And she dreamed that she opened a shop, a big shop this was, on the top of a huge white cloud. She dreamed that her customers were all little boy and girl angels with floating golden curls and shining rainbow-colored wings. She dreamed that she sold nothing but cake. She used to cut generous slices from an angel cake as big as the golden dome of the Boston State House. It was very delicious, all honey and jelly and ice cream on the inside, and all frosting stuck with candies and nuts and fruits on the outside. The people on Warrington Street were surprised to learn in the course of a few days that old Mrs. Murdoch had sold out her business in the little corner store. For over a week, the little place was shut up. The school children pouring into the street twice a day had to go to Main Street for their candy and lead pencils. For a long time, all the curtains were kept down. Something was going on inside, but what could not be guessed from the outside. Wagons deposited all kinds of things at the door. Rolls of paper, tins of paint, furniture, big wooden boxes whose contents nobody could guess. Every day brought more and more workmen, and the more there were, the harder they worked. Then, as suddenly as it had begun, all the work stopped. The next morning, when the neighborhood woke up, a freshly painted sign had taken the place over the door of the dingy old black and white one. The lettering was gilt, the background a sky blue. It read, Maida's Little Shop. Once upon a time, there was a princess who was the prettiest creature in the world. And because she was so lovely, and because her hair was like the finest gold and waved and rippled nearly to the ground, she was called Pretty Goldilocks. She always wore a crown of flowers, and her dresses were embroidered with diamonds and pearls. And everyone who saw her fell in love with her. Now one of her neighbors was a young king who was not married. He was very rich and handsome. And when he heard all that was said about Pretty Goldilocks, though he had never seen her, he fell so deeply in love with her that he could neither eat nor drink. So he resolved to send an ambassador to ask her in marriage. He had a splendid carriage made for his ambassador and gave him more than 100 horses and 100 servants
and told him to be sure and bring the princess back with him. After he had started, nothing else was talked of at court, and the king felt so sure that the princess would consent that he set his people to work at pretty dresses and splendid furniture that they might be ready by the time she came. Meanwhile, the ambassador arrived at the princess's palace and delivered his little message. But whether she happened to be cross that day, or whether the compliment did not please her, is not known. She only answered that she was very much obliged to the king, but she had no wish to be married. The ambassador set off sadly on his homeward way, bringing all the king's presents back with him, for the princess was too well brought up to accept the pearls and diamonds when she would not accept the king, so she had only kept 25 English pins that he might not be vexed. When the ambassador reached the city, where the king was waiting impatiently, everybody was very much annoyed with him for not bringing the princess, and the king cried like a baby, and nobody could console him. Now there was at court a young man who was more clever and handsome than anyone else. He was called Charming, and everyone loved him, excepting a few envious people who were angry at his being the king's favorite and knowing all the state secrets. He happened to one day be with some people who were speaking of the ambassador's return and saying that his going to the princess had not done much good, when Charming said rashly, "If the king had sent me to the Princess Goldilocks, I am sure she would have come back with me." His enemies at once went to the king and said, "You will hardly believe this, sire, what Charming has the audacity to say, that if he had been sent to the Princess Goldilocks, she would certainly have come back with him. He seems to think that he is so much more handsomer than you that the princess would have fallen in love with him and followed him willingly." The king was very angry when he heard this. "Ha," said he, "does he laugh at my unhappiness and think himself more fascinating than I am? Go and let him be shut up in my great tower to die of hunger." So the king's guards went to fetch Charming, who had thought no more of his rash speech, and carried him off to prison with great cruelty. The poor prisoner had only a little straw for his bed, and but for a little stream of water which flowed through the tower, he would have died of thirst. One day, when he was in despair, he said to himself, "How can I have offended the king? I am his most faithful subject and have done nothing against him." The king chanced to be passing the tower and recognized the voice of his former favorite. He stopped to listen in spite of Charming's enemies, who tried to persuade him to have nothing more to do with the traitor. But the king said, "Be quiet. I wish to hear what he says." And then he opened the tower door and called to Charming, who came very sadly and kissed the king's hand, saying, "What have I done, sire, to deserve this cruel treatment?" "You mocked me and my ambassador," said the king, "and you said that if I had sent you for the Princess Goldilocks, you would certainly have brought her back." "It is quite true, sire," replied Charming. "I should have drawn such a picture of you and represented your good qualities in such a way that I am certain the princess would have found you irresistible. But I cannot see what there is in that to make you angry." The king could not see any cause for anger either when the matter was presented to him in this light, and he began to frown very fiercely at the courtiers who had so misrepresented his favorite. So He took Charming back to the palace with him, and after seeing that he had a very good supper, he said to him, "You know that I love pretty Goldilocks as much as ever. Her refusal has not made any difference to me, but I don't know how to make her change her mind. I really should like to send you to see if you can persuade her to marry me." Charming replied that he was perfectly willing to go and would set out the very next day. "But you must wait till I can get a grand escort for you," said the king. But Charming said that he only wanted a good horse to ride, and the king, who was delighted at his being ready to start so promptly, gave him letters to the princess and bade him good speed. It was on a Monday morning that he set out all alone upon his errand, thinking of nothing but how he could persuade the Princess Goldilocks to marry the king. He had a writing book in his pocket, and whenever any happy thought struck him, he dismounted from his horse and sat down under the trees to put it into the harangue which he was preparing for the princess before he forgot it. One day, when he had started at the very earliest dawn and was riding over a great meadow, he suddenly had a capital idea and, springing from his horse, he sat down under a willow tree which grew by a little river. When he had written it down, he was looking round him, pleased to find himself in such a pretty place, when all at once he saw a great golden carp lying gasping and exhausted upon the grass. In leaping after little flies, she had thrown herself high upon the bank, where she had lain till she was nearly dead. Charming had pity upon her, and, though he couldn't help thinking that she would have been very nice for dinner, he picked her up gently and put her back into the water. As soon as Dame Carp felt the refreshing coolness of the water, she sank down joyfully to the bottom of the river. Then, swimming up to the bank quite boldly, she said, "I thank you, Charming, for the kindness you have done me. You have saved my life. One day I will repay you." So saying, she sank down into the water again, leaving Charming greatly astonished at her politeness. Another day, as he journeyed on, he saw a raven in great distress. The poor bird was closely pursued by an eagle, which would have soon have eaten it up, had not Charming quickly fitted an arrow to his bow and shot the eagle dead. The raven perched upon a tree very joyfully. "Charming," said he, "it was very generous of you to rescue a poor raven. I am not ungrateful. Some day I will repay you." Charming thought it was very nice of the raven to say so, and went on his way. Before the sun rose, he found himself in a thick wood where it was too dark for him to see his path. And here he heard an owl crying as if it were in despair. "Hark," said he, "that must be an owl in great trouble. I am sure it has gone into a snare." And he began to hunt about, and presently found a great net which some bird catchers had spread the night before. "What a pity it is that men do nothing but torment and persecute poor creatures which never do them any harm," said he, and he took out his knife and cut the cords of the net, and the owl flitted away into the darkness. But then, turning with one flicker of her wings, she came back to Charming and said, "It does not need many words to tell you how great a service you have done me. I was caught. In a few minutes the fowlers would have been here. Without your help, I should have been killed. I am grateful, and one day I will repay you." These three adventures were the only ones of any consequence that befell Charming upon his journey, and he made all the haste he could to reach the palace of the Princess Goldilocks. When he arrived, he thought everything he saw delightful and magnificent. Diamonds were as plentiful as pebbles, and the gold and silver, the beautiful dresses, the sweetmeats and pretty things that were everywhere quite amazed him. He thought to himself, "If the princess consents to leave all this and come with me to marry the king, he may think himself lucky." Then he dressed himself carefully in rich brocade with scarlet and white plumes and threw a splendid embroidered scarf over his shoulder. And looking as handsome and as graceful as possible, he presented himself at the door of the palace, carrying in his arm a tiny pretty dog which he had bought on the way. The guards saluted him respectfully, and a messenger was sent to the princess to announce the arrival of Charming as ambassador of her neighbor, the king. "Charming," said the princess, "the name promises well. I have no doubt that he is good-looking and fascinates everybody." "Indeed he does, madam," said all her maids of honor in one breath. "We saw him from the window of the garret where we were spinning flax, and we could do nothing but look at him as long as he was in sight." "Well, to be sure," said the princess. "That's how you amuse yourselves, is it? Looking at strangers out of the window? Be quick and give me my blue satin embroidered dress and comb out my golden hair. Let somebody make me fresh garlands of flowers and give me my high-heeled shoes and my fan and tell them to sweep my great hall and my throne, for I want everyone to say I am really pretty Goldilocks." You can imagine how all her maids scurried this way and that to make the princess ready, and how in their haste they knocked their heads together and hindered each other till she thought they would never have done. However, at last, they led her into the gallery of mirrors that she might assure herself that nothing was lacking in her appearance. Then she mounted her throne of gold, ebony, and ivory, while her ladies took their guitars and began to sing softly. Then Charming was led in, and was so struck with astonishment and admiration that at first not a word could he say. But presently he took courage and delivered his harangue, bravely ending by begging the princess to spare him the disappointment of going back without her. "Sir Charming," answered she, "all the reasons you have given me are very good ones, and I assure you that I should have more pleasure in obliging you than anyone else. But you must know that a month ago, as I was walking by the river with my ladies, I took off my glove, and as I did so, a ring that I was wearing slipped off my finger and rolled into the water. As I valued it more than my kingdom, you may imagine how vexed I was at losing it, and I vowed to never listen to any proposal of marriage unless the ambassador first brought me back my ring. So now you know what is expected of you, for if you talked for 15 days and 15 nights, you could not make me change my mind." Charming was very much surprised by this answer, but he bowed low to the princess and begged her to accept the embroidered scarf and the tiny dog he had brought with him. But she answered that she did not want any presents, and that he was to remember what she had just told him. When he got back to his lodging, he went to bed without eating any supper, and his little dog, who was called Frisk, couldn't eat any either, but came and lay down close to him. All night, Charming sighed and lamented. "How am I to find a ring that fell into the river a month ago?" said he. "It is useless to try,
The princess must have told me to do it on purpose, knowing it was impossible. And then he sighed again. Frisk heard him and said, "My dear master, don't despair. The luck may change. You are too good not to be happy. Let us go down to the river as soon as it is light." But Charming only gave him two little pats and said nothing, and very soon he fell asleep. At the first glimmer of dawn, Frisk began to jump about, and when he had waked Charming, they went out together, first into the garden, and then down to the river's brink, where they wandered up and down. Charming was thinking sadly of having to go back unsuccessful when he heard someone calling, "Charming, Charming." He looked all about him and thought he must be dreaming, as he could not see anybody. Then he walked on and the voice called again, "Charming, Charming." "Who calls me?" said he. Frisk, who was very small and could look closely into the water, cried out, "I see a golden carp coming." And sure enough, there was the great carp, who said to Charming, "You saved my life in the meadow by the willow tree, and I promised that I would repay you. Take this. It is the Princess Goldilocks' ring." Charming took the ring out of Dame Carp's mouth, thanking her 1,000 times, and he and Tiny Frisk went straight to the palace, where someone told the princess that he was asking to see her. "Ah, poor fellow," said she. "He must have come to say goodbye, finding it impossible to do as I asked." So in came Charming, who presented her with the ring and said, "Madam, I have done your bidding. Will it please you to marry my master?" When the princess saw her ring brought back to her unhurt, she was so astonished that she thought she must be dreaming. "Truly, Charming," said she, "you must be the favorite of some fairy, or you could never have found it." "Madam," answered he, "I was helped by nothing but my desire to obey your wishes." "Since you are so kind," said she, "perhaps you will do me another service, for till it is done, I will never be married. There is a prince not far from here whose name is Galifron, who once wanted to marry me, but when I refused, he uttered the most terrible threats against me and vowed that he would lay waste my country. But what could I do? I could not marry a frightful giant as tall as a tower, who eats up people as a monkey eats chestnuts, and who talks so loud that anybody who has to listen to him becomes quite deaf. Nevertheless, he does not cease to persecute me and to kill my subjects. So before I can listen to your proposal, you must kill him." Charming was rather dismayed at this command, but he answered, "Very well, princess. I will fight this Galifron. I believe that he will kill me, but at any rate, I shall die in your defense." Then the princess was frightened and said everything she could think of to prevent Charming from fighting the giant, but it was of no use, and he went out to arm himself suitably, and then, taking little Frisk with him, he mounted his horse and set out for Galifron's country. Everyone he met told him what a terrible giant Galifron was, and that nobody dared go near him. And the more he heard, the more frightened he grew. Frisk tried to encourage him by saying, "While you are fighting the giant, dear master, I will go and bite his heels. And when he stoops down to look at me, you can kill him." Charming praised his little dog's plan, but knew that this help would not do much good. At last, he drew near the giant's castle and saw to his horror that every path that led to it was strewn with bones. Before long, he saw Galifron coming. His head was higher than the tallest trees, and he sang in a terrible voice. "Bring out your little boys and girls. Pray do not stay to do their curls, for I shall eat so very many, I shall not know if they have any." Thereupon Charming sang out as loud as he could to the same tune. "Come out and meet the valiant Charming, who finds you not at all alarming. Although he is not very tall, he's big enough to make you fall." The rhymes were not very correct, but you see, he had made them up so quickly that it is a miracle that they were not worse, especially as he was horribly frightened all the time. When Galifron heard these words, he looked all about him and saw Charming standing, sword in hand, and this put the giant into a terrible rage. He aimed a blow at Charming with his huge iron club, which would certainly have killed him if it had reached him. However, at that instant, a raven perched upon the giant's head and, pecking with its strong beak and beating with its great wings, so confused and blinded him that all his blows fell harmlessly upon the air, and Charming, rushing in, gave him several strokes with his sharp sword, so that he fell to the ground dead. Soon after, the raven from a tree close by croaked out, "You see, I have not forgotten the good turn you did me in killing the eagle. Today, I think I have fulfilled my promise of repaying you. Indeed, I owe you more gratitude than you ever owed me," replied Charming. And then he mounted his horse and rode off. When he reached the city, the people ran after him in crowds, crying, "Behold the brave Charming who has killed the giant." And their shouts reached the princess's ear, but she dared not ask what was happening, for fear she should hear that Charming had been killed. But very soon he arrived at the palace. "Princess," said Charming, "I have killed your enemy. I hope you will now consent to marry the king, my master." "Oh dear, no," said the princess, "not until you have brought me some water from the gloomy cavern. Not far from here, there is a deep cave, the entrance to which is guarded by two dragons with fiery eyes, who will not allow anyone to pass them. When you get into the cavern, you will find an immense hole, which you must go down, and it is full of toads and snakes. At the bottom of this hole, there is another little cave, in which rises the fountain of health and beauty. It is some of this water that I really must have. Everything it touches becomes wonderful. The beautiful things will always remain beautiful, and the ugly things become lovely. If one is young, one never grows old, and if one is old, one becomes young. You see, Charming, I could not leave my kingdom without taking some of it with me." "Princess," said he, "you at least can never need this water, but I am an unhappy ambassador whose death you desire. Where you send me, I will go, though I know I shall never return." And as the Princess Goldilocks showed no sign of relenting, he started with his little dog for the gloomy cavern. Everyone he met on the way said, "What a pity that a handsome young man should throw away his life so carelessly. He is going to the cavern alone, though if he had 100 men with him, he could not succeed.
Why does the princess ask impossibilities? Charming said nothing, but he was very sad. When he was near the top of a hill, he dismounted to let his horse graze, while Frisk amused himself by chasing flies. Charming knew he could not be far from the gloomy cavern, and on looking about him, he saw a black, hideous rock from which came a thick smoke, followed in a moment by one of the dragons with fire blazing from his mouth and eyes. His body was yellow and green, and his claws scarlet, and his tail was so long that it lay in 100 coils. Frisk was so terrified at the sight of it that he did not know where to hide. Charming, quite determined to get the water or die, now drew his sword and, taking the crystal flask which Pretty Goldilocks had given him to fill, said to Frisk, "I feel sure that I shall never come back from this expedition. When I am dead, go to the princess and tell her that her errand has cost me my life. Then find the king, my master, and relate all my adventures to him." As he spoke, he heard a voice calling, "Charming, Charming." "Who calls me?" said he. Then he saw an owl sitting in a hollow tree who said to him, "You saved my life when I was caught in the net. Now I can repay you. Trust me with the flask, for I know all the ways of the gloomy cavern and can fill it from the fountain of beauty." Charming was only too glad to give her the flask, and she flitted into the cavern quite unnoticed by the dragon, and after some time returned with the flask, filled to the very brim with sparkling water. Charming thanked her with all his heart and joyfully hastened back to the town. He went straight to the palace and gave the flask to the princess, who had no further objection to make. So she thanked Charming and ordered that preparations should be made for her departure, and they soon set out together. The princess found Charming such an agreeable companion that she sometimes said to him, "Why didn't we stay where we were? I could have made you king, and we should have been so happy." But Charming only answered, "I could not have done anything that would have vexed my master so much, even for a kingdom, or to please you, though I think you are as beautiful as the sun." At last, they reached the king's great city, and he came out to meet the princess, bringing magnificent presents, and the marriage was celebrated with great rejoicings. But Goldilocks was so fond of Charming that she could not be happy unless he was near her, and she was always singing his praises. "If it hadn't been for Charming," she said to the king, "I should never have come here. You ought to be very much obliged to him, for he did the most impossible things and got me water from the fountain of beauty, so I can never grow old and shall get prettier every year." Then Charming's enemy said to the king, "It is a wonder that you're not jealous. The queen thinks there is nobody in the world like Charming, as if anybody you had sent could not have done just as much." "It is quite true, now I come to think of it," said the king. "Let him be chained hand and foot and thrown into the tower." So they took Charming, and as a reward for having served the king so faithfully, he was shut up in the tower, where he only saw the jailer, who brought him a piece of black bread and a pitcher of water every day. However, little Frisk came to console him and told him all the news. When Pretty Goldilocks heard what had happened, she threw herself at the king's feet and begged him to set Charming free.
But the more she cried, the more angry he was, and at last she saw that it was useless to say any more, but it made her very sad. Then the king took it into his head that perhaps he was not handsome enough to please the Princess Goldilocks, and he thought he would bathe his face with the water from the Fountain of Beauty, which was in the flask on a shelf in the princess's room, where she had placed it that she might see it often. Now it happened that one of Princess's ladies, in chasing a spider, had knocked the flask off the shelf and broken it, and every drop of water had been spilt. Not knowing what to do, she had hastily swept away the pieces of crystal, and then remembered that in the king's room she had seen a flask of exactly the same shape, also filled with sparkling water. So, without saying a word, she fetched it and stood it upon the queen's shelf. Now the water in this flask was what was used in the kingdom for getting rid of troublesome people. Instead of having their heads cut off in the usual way, their faces were bathed with the water, and they instantly fell asleep and never woke up anymore. So when the king, thinking to improve his beauty, took the flask and sprinkled the water upon his face, he fell asleep, and nobody could wake him. Little Frisk was the first to hear the news, and he ran to tell Charming, who sent him to beg the princess not to forget the poor prisoner. All the palace was in confusion on account of the king's death, but Tiny Frisk made his way through the crowd to the princess's side and said, "Madam, do not forget poor Charming." Then she remembered all he had done for her, and without saying a word to anyone, went straight to the tower, and with her own hands took off Charming's chains. Then, putting a golden crown upon his head and the royal mantle upon his shoulders, she said, "Come, faithful Charming, I make you king and will take you for my husband." Charming, once more free and happy, fell at her feet and thanked her for her gracious words. Everybody was delighted that he should be king, and the wedding, which took place at once, was the prettiest that can be imagined, and Prince Charming and Princess Goldilocks lived happily ever after. Once there was a farmer with two sons. One morning he said to them, "Boys, you're old enough now to marry, but in our family we have our own way to choose a bride." The younger son listened respectfully, but the older one said, "You've told us, father. We must each cut down a tree and see where it points." "That's right," said the farmer. "Then walk that way till you find a sweetheart. That's how we've done it, and that's how we always will." Now the older son already knew who he wanted to marry. He also knew how to cut a tree so it fell how he wanted. So his tree fell and pointed to the farm where his sweetheart lived. The younger son, whose name was Miko, didn't have a sweetheart, but he thought he'd try his luck in the town. Well, maybe he cut the tree wrong, or maybe it had thoughts of its own, but it fell pointing to the forest. "Good job, Miko," his brother mocked. "What sweetheart will you find there, a wolf or a fox?" "Never mind," said Miko. "I'll find who I find." The two young men went their ways. Miko walked through the forest for hours without seeing a soul, but at last he came to a cottage deep in the woods.
I knew I'd find a sweetheart, said Mikko. But when he went inside, he saw no one.
All this way for nothing, he said sadly.
Maybe not, came a tiny voice.
Mikko looked around, but the only living thing in sight was a little mouse on a table. Standing on its hind legs, it gazed at him with large, bright eyes.
Did you say something? He asked it.
Of course I did.
Now, why don't you tell me your name and what you came for?
Mikko had never talked with a mouse, but he felt it only polite to reply.
My name is Mikko, and I've come looking for a sweetheart.
The mouse squealed in delight.
Why, Mikko, I'll gladly be your sweetheart.
But you're only a mouse, said Mikko.
That may be true, she said, but I can still love you faithfully. Besides, even a mouse can be special. Come feel my fur.
With one finger, Mikko stroked the mouse's back.
Why? It feels like velvet, just like the gown of a princess.
That's right, Mikko.
And as he petted her, she sang to him prettily.
Miko's sweetheart will I be. What a fine young man is he. Gown of velvet I do wear, like a princess, fine and rare.
Mikko looked into those large, bright eyes and thought she really was quite nice for a mouse. And since he'd found no one else anyway, he said,
All right, little mouse, you can be my sweetheart.
Oh, Mikko, she said happily, I promise you won't be sorry.
Mikko wasn't too sure, but he just stroked her fur and smiled.
When Mikko got home, his brother was already there boasting to their father.
My sweetheart has rosy red cheeks and long golden hair.
Sounds very nice, said the farmer.
And what about yours, Mikko?
Yes, Mikko, said his brother, laughing. Did you find a sweetheart with a nice fur coat?
Now, Mikko didn't want to admit his sweetheart was a mouse. So he said, Mine wears a velvet gown like a princess.
His brother stopped laughing.
Well, said the farmer, it sounds like Miko's tree pointed a good way too. But now I must test both your sweethearts. Tomorrow you'll ask them to weave you some cloth, then you'll bring it home to me. That's how we've done it, and that's how we always will. They started out early next morning. When Mikko reached the cottage in the woods, there was the little mouse on the table. She jumped up and down and clapped her tiny paws.
Oh, Mikko, I'm so glad you're here. Is this the day of our wedding?
Mikko gently stroked her fur.
Not yet, little mouse, he said glumly.
Why, Mikko, you look so sad. What's wrong?
My father wants you to weave some cloth. But how can you do that? You're only a mouse.
That may be true, she said. But I'm also your sweetheart. And surely Miko's sweetheart can weave.
But you must be tired from your walk. Why don't you rest while I work?
All right, said Mikko, yawning. He lay down on a bed in the corner, and the little mouse sang him a pretty lullaby.
Miko's sweetheart will I be. What a fine young man is he. Cloth of linen I will weave. All be done when he must leave.
When the little mouse was sure that Mikko was asleep, she picked up a sleigh bell on a cord and rang it. Out of mouse holes all around the room poured hundreds of mice. They all stood before the table gazing up at her. "Hurry," she said. "Each of you, fetch a strand of the finest flax." The mice rushed from the cottage. Then one, two, three, and back they were, each with a strand of flax. First, they spun it into yarn on the spinning wheel. Whirr, whirr, whirr. Some worked the pedal, some fed the flax, some rode around with the wheel. Then they strung the yarn on the loom and wove it into cloth. Swish thunk, swish thunk, swish thunk. Some worked the pedals, some rocked the beater, some sailed the shuttle back and forth. At last, they cut the cloth from the loom and tucked it in a nutshell. "Now, off with you," said the little mouse, and they all scampered back to their mouse holes. Then she called, "Miko, wake up. It's time to go home, and here is something for your father." Miko sleepily took the nutshell. He didn't know why his father should want such a thing, but he said, "Thank you, little mouse." When he got home, his brother was proudly presenting the cloth from his sweetheart. The father looked it over and said, "Strong and fairly even. Good enough for simple folks like us. And where is yours, Miko?" Miko blushed and handed him the nutshell. "Look at that," said his brother. Miko asked for cloth, and his sweetheart gave him a nut. But the farmer opened the nutshell and peered inside. Then he pinched at something and started to pull. Out came linen, fine beyond belief. It kept coming too, yard after yard after yard. Miko's brother gaped with open mouth, and Miko did too. "There can be no better weaver than Miko's sweetheart," declared the farmer. "But both your sweethearts will do just fine. Tomorrow, you'll bring them home for the wedding. That's how we've done it, and that's how we always will." When Miko arrived at the cottage next morning, the little mouse again jumped up and down. "Oh, Miko, is this the day of our wedding?" "It is, little mouse," but he sounded more glum than ever. "Why, Miko, what's wrong?" "How can I bring home a mouse to marry? My brother and father and all our friends and neighbors will laugh and think I'm a fool." "They might think so indeed," she said softly. "But, Miko, what do you think?" Miko looked at the little mouse, gazing at him so seriously with her large, bright eyes. He thought about how she loved him and cared for him. "I think you're sweet as any sweetheart could be. So let them laugh and think what they like. Today, you'll be my bride." "Oh, Miko, you've made me the happiest mouse in the world." She rang her sleigh bell, and to Miko's astonishment, a little carriage raced into the room. It was made from a nutshell and pulled by four black rats. A mouse coachman sat in front and a mouse footman behind. "Miko," said the little mouse, "aren't you going to help me down?" Miko lifted her from the table and set her in the carriage. The rats took off, and the carriage sped from the cottage so that Miko had to rush to catch up. While he hurried along behind her, the little mouse sang a pretty song. "Miko, sweetheart, will I be? What a fine young man is he! In a carriage I will ride when I go to be his bride." At last, they reached the farm, and then the spot for the wedding.
on the bank of a lovely, swift-flowing stream. The guests were already there enjoying themselves, but as Miko came up, they all grew silent and stared at the little carriage. Miko's brother stood with his bride, gaping in disbelief. Miko and the little mouse went up to him. "That's the stupidest thing I ever saw," said his brother, and with one kick sent the carriage, the rats, and the mice all into the stream. Before Miko could do a thing, the current bore them away.
"What have you done?" cried Miko. "You've killed my sweetheart."
"Are you crazy?" said his brother. "That was only a mouse."
"She may have been a mouse," said Miko tearfully, "but she was also my sweetheart, and I really did love her."
He was about to swing at his brother when his father called, "Miko, look!" All the guests were staring downstream and pointing and crying out in wonder. Miko turned and, to his amazement, saw four black horses pulling a carriage out of the stream. A coachman sat in front and a footman behind, and inside was a soaked but lovely princess in a gown of pearly velvet. The carriage rode up along the bank and stopped right before him. "Miko," said the princess, "aren't you going to help me down?" Miko stared blankly a moment, and then his eyes flew wide. "Are you the little mouse?"
"I surely was," said the princess, laughing, "but no longer. A witch enchanted me, and the spell could be broken only by one brother who wanted to marry me and another who wanted to kill me. But, sweetheart, I need a change of clothes. I can't be wed at our wedding." And a grand wedding it was, with Miko's bride the wonder of all. The farmer could hardly stop looking at her. Of course, Miko's brother was a bit jealous, but his own bride was really quite nice, so he couldn't feel too bad. The next day, the princess brought Miko back to her cottage, but it was a cottage no longer. It was a castle with hundreds of servants, and there they made their home where they lived happily ever after. And if Miko and Princess had any sons, you know just how they chose their brides. And as this sweet little tale now comes to an end, embrace this wonderful feeling of comfort and warmth. Let it wash over you. Welcome this feeling. Let it flow through your whole body, flowing through your toes, your feet, your legs, softening, melting, and relaxing. Flowing through your fingers, your hands, your arms. Peaceful, calm, and relaxed. Flowing through your back, loosening and releasing. Your shoulders soften and ease back, soothed by this wave of relaxation that is now spreading through your neck, your face, and your scalp.
You feel calm. You feel relaxed. You feel completely at ease. And in this pleasant feeling of comfort and relaxation, it's so easy now to just let go and drift and float into that peaceful, blissful state. Drifting and floating, floating and drifting, going deeper and deeper down, all the way down into a sound and restful sleep. My friend, may your slumber be peaceful. May your dreams be sweet.